Dear colleagues, I would like to share with you a few thoughts on two topics that puzzled me listening to the presentations during this excellent conference. Saying that, I really hope that the organizers will be able to continue their work. So this is my outline. In the first part of my talk, I will try to share some thoughts on integration and the biopsychosocial model and its difficulties. And therefore, I need to introduce very briefly an idea, a vision on human functioning as a structural whole, as I call it. And in my second part, I will explain to you a model of spiritual relationships, which, in my view, can be very helpful in assessment of the spirituality, the spiritual life of our patients. So that's what I'm going to try to do within, let's say, 30 or less than 40 minutes. What do we mean by integrated treatment or integrated psychotherapy? In a general sense, what we try to do is explain in the first place that still a lot of people, perhaps even a growing number of people worldwide, is religiously or spiritually involved. That in the second place, research data show that religion and spirituality can have beneficial and adverse effects on health. And that therefore, in the third place, psychiatrists and psychotherapists should be competent or should develop the ability to inquire into the religious and spiritual life of patients, that such an inquiry should communicate respect and curiosity for this dimension of the patient's life, and that psychotherapists should be aware of the potential misuse or even abuse in case the principle of psychotherapeutic neutrality is abandoned. However, this program is still much debated. Since Harold Koenig published an editorial in the British Psychiatric Bulletin, nowadays it's called The Psychiatrist, in 2008, the Royal College of Psychiatrists and the Spirituality and Psychiatry Special Interest Group of the Royal College became implicated in a controversy with often heated responses to that paper entitled Religion and Mental Health, What Should Psychiatrists Do? In this line of thinking, integration is foremost a matter of attitude, knowledge, and skills. And no doubt, this is an essential component of integration of psychiatry or psychotherapy and spirituality. But it does not guarantee any actual integration in clinical psychiatry and psychotherapy. As such, integration still seems to depend on those colleagues who, for their own reasons, are spiritually involved, devoted themselves, and therefore show not only interest in the topic, but also try to integrate their views professionally. Unfortunately, opponents do not hesitate to point at a conflict of interest. As you might have noticed, in the British Journal of Psychiatry, a discussion was opened on whether psychiatrists and therapists should or should not disclose their own background position in full, at least in case of controversial issues. In other words, it might still be the case that taking a religiously position is seen unacceptably prejudiced, whereas taking a non-religious stance, even at the expense of the patient's discomfort, is regarded as normal practice. Because of that presumed strong conflict of interest, it is still feared that the whole topic of psychiatry and religion is just to evangelize patients and is more or less a dangerous threat to appropriate boundaries in current clinical practice. In fact, physicians, including psychiatrists, have nothing to do whatsoever with religion and spirituality, and better not. How could we possibly get the topic of psychiatry and spirituality out of this mixture of misunderstanding and trap? In other words, integration, still problematic, is at best a therapeutic necessity and an ethical duty depending on your personal background and worldview. And stated this, there is still no inner logic to strive for integration. By inner logic, I mean a way of reasoning based on a view of human functioning as a structural whole. A structural whole that encompasses substructures and has its own internal destiny and functions. Compare a statue. A statue is a structural whole in the sense that a physical material, marble, as a part structure, keeps functioning according to the physical laws for physical materials in general, and at the same time is bound and determined by its functioning within the larger whole, that is the statue, that is qualified by its aesthetic function. The aesthetic function is a potential property or quality that can be opened up or is anticipated in the material the marble, the statue is made of. However, this opening up is not necessary to recognize the statue as a statue. A human being is a structural whole. In the sense that, for instance, the physical material as a part structure keeps functioning according to the physical and biotic laws for physical material and biological processes in general. And at the same time, that part structure is bound and determined by its functioning within the structural whole, the human being, that is qualified by a rich diversity of functions, like social functioning, moral functioning, pistic, spiritual functioning, and other functions. Let me put it in another way. The point I want to stress is this. We are used to the idea that certain objects have primary and secondary properties. Primary properties belong to the objects themselves. Secondary properties are ascribed to the object. For instance, economical or aesthetic properties. The difference between these primary and secondary properties is the difference between a known object and the knowing subject that ascribes these secondary properties to an object. In our view, these so-called secondary properties are not just ascriptions or even projections by the subject, but properties or potential qualities of the object itself, which are disclosed or opened up in interaction with the subject. Look again at the statue. The aesthetic property is not just an ascription to the statue by the spectators. It is in the first place a potential property of the material which is disclosed, opened up in the interaction with the spectators. Religiosity, spirituality, meaning giving is not something we just ascribe to human beings, no. It is in the first place one of the higher functions of the structural whole the human being is. Therefore, meaning giving, or the so-called pistic function in this model, is not a secondary property in the old sense, a property we ascribe to, project onto human beings, but it is a property, a mode of functioning of human beings as such, which is disclosed or opened up in interaction between humans. What does this way of reasoning mean with regard to the biopsychosocial model? The biopsychosocial model is primarily used in clinical practice as a non-reductionist approach to mental disorder. However, the model is not clear whatsoever about how these three or even four dimensions relate. Are they just levels of increasing complexity, as George Engel suggested in his first publication? Do they have their own language and methods? In that sense, the model does not explain anything, and therefore it isn't even a model. The biopsychosocial model lacks an integrative framework and does not explain how these levels, three or four, or domains work together. And the biopsychosocial model is not open to meaning-centered aspects of illness and health. However, it might be possible to reformulate the BPS model such that it is open to religion and spirituality, and that it integrates empirical findings at the interface of psychiatry and religion. A reformulation along these lines would integrate the spiritual dimension in clinical practice and would allow the use of spiritual resources in coping with illness and in managing one's problems. Therefore, I repeat my reformulation. Human functioning can be analyzed as a structural whole in which substructures are interwoven without loss of their relative independence. The structural whole has its own internal destination. Human emotions, as part of the psychic substructure, prepare for an immense diversity of acts and acts-like behaviors. And this preparing for is called anticipation. Anticipation refers to the reflection of elements of the higher functions within human emotional life, which as such is part of the psychic structure. So emotional life is co-determined by analogical moments which anticipate the higher functions of the structural whole. Feelings as trust and hope can be interpreted as feelings that anticipate faith and spiritual life. As such, as feelings, they remain within the boundaries of emotional life. However, the words trust and hope may denote other events, acts of trust, acts of hope, acts that bear witness of our confidence in somebody or in a certain state of affairs. Take, for instance, hope. Hope is an affective disposition which expresses itself in a variety of ways. In a weaker sense, it means something like a positive expectation, having confidence in the future. Hope is reaching out to what is not yet there, in the anticipation of something positive to come. The opening up of feeling leads to more concrete expectations, which include a cognitive dimension. And these expectations are not merely private. They may be shared with other people, explicitly or implicitly. So the psychic sphere is opened up to the social and to the level of institutions and society, and finally to the realm of meaning, moral, and aesthetics. So if emotional life opens up to these higher levels of functioning, they are no longer just expressions of the self. They become social by attuning to the wishes, feelings, and interests of others around us. And each of the higher levels adds another connotation to the feeling. So the refinement I propose is based on a view of human functioning as a structural whole in which substructures are interwoven. Each lower substructure is encompassed in the next by the next higher substructure, the structural whole encompassing them all. And each encompassed or underlying substructure functions in a foundational sense within the higher substructure. Each substructure is qualified by the function which is used to denote them. And the structural whole is open to a wide variety of functions, including spiritual life. That's my first part. Let me move on now to the second part. Spiritual life is characteristically relational life. We usually make a distinction between relatedness and relationship. Relatedness aims at an aspect of existence, of being. Being as understood is understood as being with others. In the beginning was relation, as the well-known philosopher Martin Buber stated in his famous I and Thou, Ich und Du. Meaning that not the individual, but relationships are primary. Embedded in a network of relationships, individuality arises out of relational experiences and not the other way around. And this is not just a matter of the very beginning, but it continues to be important and whole life long. Our identity and our value as persons are determined by the fellowship with others. That is, I have my own characteristics that make me the person I am, my ideas, my convictions, my emotions and needs, wishes and desires, which give purpose, value, and coherence to my own life and actions. However, this authenticity is a necessary condition for having my identity as a person, but it is not sufficient. And it is here that the relational aspect of having a personal identity comes into the picture. We need others in order to develop as full and authentic human beings. That is what we mean by relatedness. Nothing less than a fundamental characteristic of human being and human development, of being created in the image of God, putting it in a Christian perspective. Relationships, therefore, are something more specific that link people to each other, can be present or lacking, can change because a change in one partner of the relationship can trigger change in the others and vice versa. In spiritual life, we can stipulate the same. Spiritual relatedness refers to our being in a state of intersubjectivity with others, with the supreme other, or how it is called. That holds even true when we are aware of it or not. In spiritual relationships, we see the particular way in which individuals and communities construe their involvement or connectedness with the transcendent. And if that is true, and it is in my view, it would be helpful to have an instrument or a way of looking at to assess spiritual relationships. If that would be possible, it would not only be helpful in getting a more clear view on somebody's spiritual relationship, it would also help to look at the potential for change. The Dutch philosopher Vincent Brümer developed a division of interpersonal and spiritual relationships into three identifiable basic types. These three types, categories, are impersonal or manipulative relationships, agreements about rights and obligations or contractual relationships, and mutual love or fellowship relationships. According to this approach, these three basic categories function as root metaphors or key models in various theologies. In other words, if you are able to analyze a theology, you will find that the relationship between God and man it implies is modeled as an analogy to one of these basic types of spiritual relationships. And it is my assumption that this model is very helpful indeed, because it enables us as therapists to give an account of the dynamics in these type of spiritual relationships, as I will try to explain to you in the next part of my talk. Each type of spiritual relationship can be examined as to which relational capacities are involved and are practiced. Each category can also be examined as to what are the immature and restrictive ways of constructing spiritual life. And again, positive and negative possibilities of these types of relationships allow us to assess the potential for therapeutic change. So let me explain and describe to you what is meant by these three types of spiritual relationships. Why do we call the first type impersonal? Well, because it is impersonal in the sense that only one partner is his own agent. The other is treated if he or she were an object, a thing, a non-person. Therefore, relationships like these are called asymmetrical, because one partner has complete control over the other partner. It does not mean that such a relationship cannot be beneficent for the other under control, but one in control, the one in control, treats the other as an object rather than a person. He forces or manipulates the other instead of asking or convincing. And such impersonal relationship is not based on mutual positive feelings, simply because it is not possible to manipulate a commitment. Only free personal agents can commit themselves. Slavery can be seen as such a relationship, but also an incestuous relationship. In incestuous relationships, one of the partners is treated and manipulated as an object. And don't forget medical practice. Perhaps patients doesn't say such things in your country, but what does a patient mean when he say that he feels treated like a number? In such a case, the patient is, or apparently feels, like the one who needs to be cured as an object, the one that needs to be operated on. In what kind of theology do we recognize this type of impersonal relations, spiritual relationships? By theology, I do not only mean academic, communal theology, but also the personal theology of the person involved. Well, if God's action is thought to be the direct cause of everything, then the human being is totally dependent for everything. Theologies in this sense are determinist theologies. The divine being is in absolute control. Man has no free choice to either to accept or to reject whatever good or bad that God allows to him. Another example would be belief in fate, which never, however hard we try, can be avoided. Prayer in this type of relationship is nothing more than a way to accept the inevitable, although that may contribute to inner peace or may help to cope. It is also not impossible that the one who is manipulated tries to manipulate by using magic rituals. Using rituals within this relational context may contribute to a feeling of strength. Of course, is the doctrine of predestination in risk of being such a determinist theology. I only mention it, but cannot go into this now. Just one thing about that, we should realize that such a doctrinal system as a whole also has many other counterbalancing aspects which can be more beneficial to a balanced spirituality. Determinist worldviews and meaning systems, like certain communal and personal theologies, are conducive to a basic attitude of passivity and fatalism. However, you will always meet people who, despite the fact that they are not in a position to act as a free and responsible person, who still have the inner freedom to choose a certain attitude and develop the qualities it requires. So the potential for change has to do with this notion of inner freedom. From a spiritual point of view, it is possible to change an attitude of servitude towards willing obedience or humility. And some people do indeed reach an impressive inner strength and peace in that way. But for therapists, it might be pretty difficult to understand and empathize with such a worldview. The second type is the category of mutual agreement or contractual human and spiritual relationships. This type, according to Brummer, is based on mutual agreement. Two persons accept certain rights and duties toward each other. Take, for example, your marriage. Of course, you have always been thinking, I assume, that your marriage is based on mutual fellowship and love, and perhaps it still is. But there is always an aspect of mutual agreement and obligation, for better or for worse. And by the way, I cannot exclude completely the possibility that an impersonal trait might be there too. In the Netherlands, we have that saying that her only right is her sink unit. And in Dutch, these two words, right and sink unit, are very similar and differ only by a prefix. Is there any similar expression in your language? In other words, most relationships are mixtures of the three categories, but I assume you already imagined that such a mixture would be the case. Mutual agreement is like the relationship between an employer and an employee. The agreement is about work and payment. People recognize the claims which they make on each other with a view to the advantage which each partner can gain for himself. Agreements may be formally agreed upon, they may be informal. There is an enormous variety. However, the case is always that the goods or services which one partner receives from the other according to the agreement constitute an interest which the recipient could only realize by means of the agreement. And that is exactly the difference, as we will see, in comparison with relations of mutual love. Because in mutual fellowship or love, one chooses to serve the interests of the other and not primarily his own. So therefore, in agreements of rights and duties, the relationship has a certain instrumental value for me as a means for furthering my own interests. And as such, they are replaceable. Nevertheless, different from impersonal relationships, both partners can be emotionally involved and commit themselves to act for the good of the other, but they both benefit from it. Love may be a factor, but not necessarily so. Marriages are not always entered for love. So loss of love does not automatically end this type of relationship. Good and fair fulfillment of mutual obligations is decisive. And in contrast to impersonal relationships, mutual agreements are symmetrical relationships. Partners freely decide to enter into them. Mutual agreements are not coercive, but they do create obligations. To put it in another way, I can buy, earn, or merit your services, but not your fellowship or friendship or love. In spiritual relationships of mutual agreement, we also see that a relationship is a personal one. Both the Almighty and the human being, although fundamentally different, acknowledge each other as partners, and both partners are responsible to each other for continuity and quality of the relationship. The classical biblical notion is obviously the covenant, and within that place, the place of the will of God and obedience to that will. In the impersonal model, the human person is object of the divine will. It is something that simply overcomes you, just that. In the personal model, things are different. The will of God is something to be done. Misfortune is not something that overcomes you. You might be angry or disappointed, but in case of misfortune, the question is how to do God's will in these circumstances. Either from a sense of obligation, as in agreement relationships, or from the heart, as in love relationships. The main challenge with such spiritual relationships confront people, the main challenge with which such spiritual relationships confront people is that they encourage them to focus on performing the obligations from the agreement they are involved in. And usually this comes down to a focus on morality. Many religions are in fact contractual. People pay their duties in order to receive the promised blessings. And in theologies using this kind of relationship, both partners are vulnerable, but freedom and responsibility are granted to men. People are not forced, but invited to share responsibilities. And as I said, the covenant is the prototype of this relationship, and theologies like these have been and are very influential, and especially known for their satisfaction theology. Jesus Christ offered himself as a substitute to undergo the punishment humanity deserves for its sins, and in doing so, he has saved humanity from eternal damnation. Mutual love or fellowship. As I said, in relations of mutual fellowship, I choose to serve the interest of the other and not primarily my own. I not only do recognize your interests, but I identify myself with you by treating your interests and your claims as my own. And in that sense, I love you as myself. I want your good, not merely as much as I want my own, but as being my own. Aristotle defined a friend as a heteros autos, another self. Therefore, the partner has no longer just an instrumental value. In relations of fellowship, where I identify with you and treat your interests as my own, your value and the value of our relationship becomes intrinsic for me. And as such, neither you nor our relationship can be replaced by another. Other relationships of fellowship with other people could also be rewarding and satisfying, but they are never the same, since you, as the person who is the reason for having the relationship, would be missing. These relationships play a very important role in our existence, since we own our value and identity as persons to such relations. Personal value and identity are bestowed on me by the fact that others consider me irreplaceable to them. That's what our self-esteem secures and what gives body to our sense of identity. And of course, for religious believers, this applies especially to fellowship with God. The ultimate value of my very existence is bestowed on me by the fact that God loves me and not merely my services apart from me. Fellowship is not coercive. I do not further your interest because I'm obliged to do so in order to merit your serving my interests in return. I cannot buy or merit your fellowship. Lovers give each other everything freely. Therefore, fellowship is more risky, since there is much more at stake. My value as a person is at stake. If you refuse my fellowship, you reject me. When valuing the other for himself, I put myself personally at risk. I'm involved as a person and not as an impersonal evaluator. Bestowing love on the other is totally different from evaluation of the other. Love creates value in its object and does not merely recognize it. As I said, our identity as persons is bestowed on us in the love which others have for us. However, the relation between love and person is also the other way around. Our identity is equally determined by the love we have for others. In spiritual relationships modeled in this way, we see the same vulnerability of both partners because neither can compel, cause, or oblige the other to reciprocate. It might that the Supreme Being is surprisingly more vulnerable because he keeps his commitments, whereas we all too often breach or just forget ours. In such theologies, salvation is not merely based on satisfaction, but on forgiveness. The partner who forgives has to pay the price for reconciliation because he is willing to suffer the consequences of the wrong done to him rather than lose the friend or beloved. The death of Christ reveals the extent of God's willingness to forgive. Prayer in spiritual mutual love relationship is opening up towards God. And change from this perspective is not merely primarily change of behavior. I have to change in learning receptivity, inwardness, trust, reverence, obedience, and so on. And especially the capacity to accept forgiveness and to forgive others, to prefer to suffer rather than break the relationship with the one who has injured or betrayed me as a person. Much as in personal relationship between individuals, spiritual relationships are complex and unique. Yet, it can be very important for a therapist to assess whether and in what way a patient's spiritual relationship affects his functioning. And the three types of spiritual relationships, as well as the various combinations and modifications, still have great influence on how people find meaning and direction in their lives. You have been very kind as an audience. Thank you very much for your attention.